Okay. Did you bring anything up with you?
Just myself.
Bosch touched her arm and led her toward the front door. Outside, they walked to the Volkswagen. Bosch nodded to the officer in the patrol car. He scanned up and down the street again to check if he could see what he wasn't supposed to see. This time he even checked the sky before returning his attention to his daughter. "How's the car?" he asked.
"It's good," she said.
"A couple more up and backs and I'll get the oil changed and the tires checked."
"I can get all that done."
"You're busy."
"So are you."
This time he hugged her despite the penalty to his ribs. He kissed the top of her head. His heart hurt worse than his ribs, but he wanted her far away from him right now.
"Remember to leave a message on the house line so I know you're home," he said.
"I will," she promised.
"Love you."
"Love you." Bosch watched her drive off and around the bend. He headed back into the house, nodding once more to the patrol officer with a thanklessly boring job in the car out front. At least he had a car to sit in and wasn't posted at the front door. When he got back inside, Bosch went directly to the landline in the kitchen and pulled a business card out of his pocket. He called Lieutenant Omar Cespedes, who ran the SIS squad working the Cortez case. He didn't bother to identify himself when Cespedes picked up.
"You should have told me she came up to the house."
"Bosch? Couldn't do it. You know that. Besides, you got no phone. How am I supposed to tell you anything?"
"Bullshit," Bosch said. "You were using her as bait."
"That's totally wrong, Harry. We wouldn't do that. Not with a cop's kid. But if we had told you she was coming up, then you would have called her and turned her around. That happens, and it's a giveaway. We don't do giveaways, and you know that. We play it as it lays."
Bosch calmed a bit as he came to understand the logic of the answer.
Cespedes had a team watching Maddie, just as he had a team on Bosch and on the spot where Tranquilo Cortez had supposedly gone underground. If there was any sort of deviation in Maddie's moves, like a U-turn on a trip up to L.A., then it could tip someone else who might be watching or tailing her.
"Are we okay?" Cespedes said into the silence.
"Just let me know when she gets back safe to her house."
"Not a problem.
Check your mailbox on your way out."
"Why?"
"We put a phone in there for you, so next time we can contact you when we need to. Don't use it for anything else, it's monitored."
Bosch paused as he thought about that.
He knew that every move the SIS made was monitored and analyzed. It came with the territory. He changed the subject.
"What's the latest with Cortez?"
"Still underground. We're going to goose him after it gets dark. See what that gets us."
"I want to be there."
"Not going to happen, Bosch. Not how we work.
He was going to feed me to his dogs. I want to be there."
"And that is exactly why you won't be there. You're emotionally involved. We can't have that cluttering things. You just keep that phone handy. I'll call you when the time is right."
Cespedes disconnected.
Bosch was still bothered, but not too much. He had a plan for crashing the SIS surveillance. Bosch retrieved the messages on the landline and started clearing them one by one. They went back weeks, and most were inconsequential. He rarely used the landline anymore and let the messages pile up over time. When he got to the messages his daughter had left yesterday, he couldn't bring himself to delete them. Her emotions were raw, her fear for him real. He felt terrible what she had just gone through, but knew the messages were too pure to lose. The last one had no words. It was just Maddie's breathing, hopeful that he would simply pick up and rescue her from her fears. After hanging up, he called his own cell number. The phone had been destroyed, but he knew the number would still be active in collecting messages. 9 had accumulated over the last 36 hours. 4 were from his daughter, and 3 were from Ballard, all left when his whereabouts were unknown. As with the landline messages, Bosch did not delete these. There was also one message from Cisco, saying he had nothing new to report on Elizabeth, and asking Bosch whether he did. The last message, which had come in only an hour before, was from Mike Echevarria, and it was a call Bosch didn't want to get. Echevarria was an investigator with the medical examiner's office. Bosch had worked many homicide scenes with him, and they were professionally, if not personally, close.
Bosch had called him the night he was out looking for Elizabeth Clayton to see if she was in the morgue. She wasn't, but now Echevarria had left a message, just asking Bosch to call him back. He got right to the point when Bosch returned the call.
Harry, this woman you've been looking for? I think we have her here under a Jane Doe.
Bosch dropped his chin to his chest and leaned against the kitchen counter. He closed his eyes as he spoke.
Tell me, he said.
Okay, let's see, Echevarria said.
Female, mid-50s, found in the Sinbad Motel on Sunset Boulevard 2 days ago. She's got the RIP tattoo on her rear shoulder that you described with the name Daisy.
Bosch nodded to himself. It was Elizabeth. Echevarria continued.
Autopsy won't be till Monday or Tuesday, but all signs point to opiate overdose. According to the summary, she was found on the bed by the manager. She'd paid for one night, and he was going to shoo her out. Instead, he found her dead. Had her clothes on, body on top of the sheets. No foul play suspected, no homicide call out. Signed off by a patrol sergeant and ME staff on scene.
She didn't have ID.
No ID in the room. That's why I didn't connect it when you called. A lot of these people hide their stuff outside their rooms because they're afraid of getting ripped off after they fix and pass out or whatever. She have a car?
No. What about pills? Any extra pills?
An empty prescription bottle. The prescription scratched off. They do that too, in case they get popped. It protects the doctor, because as soon as they hit the streets again, they're going to see that same doctor. Creatures of habit.
Right.
Sorry, Harry. Sounds like you knew her.
I did. And it's better knowing than not knowing, Mike.
Any chance I can get you down here to make a formal ID, or I could shoot you a picture?
Bosch thought about that.
I'm not on a cell. How about I come in tomorrow?
Tomorrow's good. I'm off Sundays, but I'll let them know.
Thanks, man.
Talk to you, Harry.
Bosch hung up and walked through the house and out to the deck. He leaned on the railing and looked down at the freeway. He was not fully surprised by the news about Elizabeth, but was still taken aback. He wondered whether the overdose was intentional. The empty pill bottle indicated she had taken everything she'd gotten. The details made no difference either way to Bosch, because he considered her death a murder. It was a 9-year-old murder, and whoever had taken Daisy had also taken Elizabeth. Never mind that the killer had never met or even seen Elizabeth. He took everything that mattered away from her. He had killed her, just as plainly as he had killed her daughter. 2 for the price of 1. Bosch made a promise to himself. Elizabeth might be gone now, but he would renew his efforts to put a name to the killer. He would find him and make him pay. He went back into the house, closed the slider, and walked down the hall to his bedroom. He changed clothes, dressing in dark pants and shirt, and adding an old army green jacket. He threw some backup clothes and toiletries into a duffel bag, because he didn't know how long it would be until he could return. He sat down on the bed and picked up the landline. He dialed Cisco Wojciechowski's number from memory and got it right. The big man answered after 4 rings, a cautious tone in his voice, probably because he didn't recognize the number.
Yeah?
Cisco, it's Bosch. I've got bad news on Elizabeth.
Tell me.
She didn't make it. They found her in a motel room in Hollywood. Looks like an OD.
Shit.
Yeah. They stayed silent for a long moment before Cisco broke the silence.
I thought she was stronger, you know. That week I spent with her, her breaking it off cold, I saw something. I thought she could go the distance.
Yeah, me too. But I guess you never know, right?
Right.
After a few more minutes of small talk, Bosch thanked him for all he had done for Elizabeth and finished the call. He went back down the hall to the closet next to the front door, where there was a steel gun box. His abductors had taken his firearm, but Bosch had a spare weapon, a Smith & Wesson combat masterpiece, the 6-shot revolver he had carried as a patrol officer almost 40 years before. He had cleaned and maintained it regularly ever since. It was in a clip-on holster now, and Bosch attached it to his belt under the jacket.
The keys to the house in Cherokee were on the kitchen counter where Bosch had left them 2 nights before. He exited the house through the front door and pulled the phone Cespedes had left for him out of the mailbox. He took another long look around the street, checking for the surveillance but saw nothing beyond the marked car from North Hollywood Division. He went into the carport where the Cherokee awaited. As he drove down the hill, he thought about Elizabeth and her fatal sadness. He realized that the long wait for justice had been too long and not enough to keep her alive, and that his effort to help her ultimately hurt her. Getting her sober only made the pain sharper and less bearable. Was he just as guilty as the unnamed killer? Bosch knew he would carry that question for a long time. Chapter 42. Cespedes had purposely not given him the exact location of the surveillance set up on Tranquilo Cortez's hideout in Panorama City, but Bosch knew enough from sitting in SFPD briefings to be able to find the neighborhoods considered to be Sanfer strongholds in the area. And with his plan, a general knowledge was all that was needed. He dropped down out of the hills and headed north into the valley, traveling through Van Nuys and up into Panorama City. The light was leaving the sky and the streetlights were coming on. He passed tent communities and drab industrial buildings colored with graffiti. When he got to Roscoe Boulevard, he turned east, and it wasn't long before the SIS phone was buzzing in his pocket. He didn't take the first or second call. He turned into a large apartment complex where there were no rules about storing furniture and refrigerators on the balconies. He drove the length of the parking lot before turning around and driving back through. He saw young Latino men watching from a few of the balconies. The third time the phone buzzed, he took the call. "Bosch, what the fuck are you doing?" Cespedes demanded. "Hey, Speedy," Bosch said, using the nickname he had heard SIS officers use for their boss. "Just taking a drive, what's up?" "Are you trying to fuck this up?" "I don't know. Am I?" "You need to get out of here and go home." "No, I need to get in the car with you. If tonight's the night, I want to be there." "What are you talking about, tonight being the night?" "You slipped. You said you were going to Goose Cortez tonight. I went in." "Are you nuts? I told you we don't do things that way. Christ, you're not even LAPD anymore, Bosch." "You could make up a reason to have me. I could be the spotter. I know what Cortez looks like." "That would never wash. You're not part of this operation, and you're compromising it." "Then I guess I'll just continue my one-man search for Cortez. Good luck with yours." Bosch disconnected and pulled back out onto Roscoe. He hit the turn signal as soon as he came up on another apartment complex. His phone buzzed again before he got to it. He took the call. "Don't turn in there," Cespedes said. "You sure?" Bosch asked. "Looks like the kind of place where Cortez might hide out." "Bosch, keep going. There's a gas station on the right down at Woodman. I'll meet you there." "Okay, but don't keep me hanging." This time it was Cespedes who disconnected. Bosch did as instructed and kept driving. At Woodman Avenue, he pulled into a gas station and parked by a broken air pump at the edge of the property. He kept the car running and waited. After 3 minutes, a black Mustang hardtop with smoked windows streaked into the station and pulled in next to Bosch's car. The passenger side window lowered and Bosch saw Cespedes behind the wheel. He had dark skin and a gray crew cut. The angular cut to his jaw seemed perfect for a man who led a team of hard chargers and sharpshooters. "Hey, Speedy," Bosch said. "Hey, asshole," Cespedes said. "You know, you are fucking up a solid operation here." "Doesn't have to be that way. Am I riding with you or not?" "Get in." Bosch exited the Jeep and locked it. He then got into the Mustang. It was a tight squeeze because of an open laptop sitting on a swivel mount attached to the dash. The screen was angled toward Cespedes, but once Bosch was in his seat, he turned the mount so he could see the screen. It was quartered into four camera views of Roscoe Boulevard in an apartment building. Bosch recognized the complex he had been about to turn into when Cespedes agreed to allow Harry to ride with him. "You got cameras on your cars?" Bosch asked. "I guess I was getting close." He pointed at the apartment building on one of the camera views. Cespedes abruptly turned the screen back toward himself. "Don't touch," he ordered. Bosch raised his hands in acknowledgement. Put on your seatbelt, Cespedes added. You don't leave this car unless I tell you to. Got that?
Got it, Bosch said.
Cespedes dropped the Mustang into reverse and pulled out of the slot next to the Jeep. The car then shot forward and back toward Roscoe. Two blocks down, he pulled to the curb in a spot where there was a view of the apartment complex that the cameras on the other cars were focused on. Cespedes canted his head back and spoke toward the ceiling of the car.
Sierra 2, show me back at OP1.
Bosch knew there was a microphone behind the visor, probably activated with the foot switch on the floor. Standard surveillance gear. A series of clicks from other cars followed. Cespedes had observation point 1. The others had views from other angles on the apartment complex. Cespedes turned to Bosch.
Now we wait, he said.
Bosch understood why they were waiting for darkness. The night always favored the followers. Cars became headlights, unrecognizable in the rearview mirror. Drivers became silhouettes.
How are you going to goose him into moving? Bosch asked.
Cespedes was quiet a moment, and Bosch knew he was deciding how much to tell Bosch. The SIS was a very insular group within the department. Once officers transferred in, they never transferred out. They cut off relationships and contact with old partners and friends in the department. In the 50-year history of the unit, there had only been one woman ever assigned to the team.
Foothill Gangs has a deep cover snitch, Cespedes said. He got us the cell number of a shot caller on the same level as Cortez. We hijacked the cell and sent Cortez a message about a must-attend meeting regarding you, Bosch, at Hanson Dam. We're hoping that does the trick.
Cespedes had just described at least two things that were compromising, if not outright against department protocol, not to mention illegal, if hijacking the phone had been done without a warrant. He was attempting to draw Bosch in and make him complicit in what might go down later. If Bosch didn't object now, he couldn't claim innocence afterward. And that was all right with him.
Why Hanson Dam? He asked.
The truth, Cespedes said. No cameras up there. He turned to look at Bosch. It was another moment where Bosch could either raise a flag or go along.
Good plan, he said, putting himself all in.
The SIS held a unique position in the LAPD, often investigated by outside agencies ranging from the FBI to the media to civil rights groups, often sued by the families of the suspects shot. Routinely labeled a death squad by outraged attorneys, the unit enjoyed a completely opposite reputation within the rank and file of the department. Infrequent openings in the unit brought hundreds of applications, including from those willing to drop pay grades just to get in. The reason was that more so than any other unit, this was seen as true police work. The SIS took violent offenders off the board. Whether they were taken alive didn't matter. They took out shooters, rapists, serial killers. The ripple effect of crimes not committed because of SIS captures and kills was unquantifiable but huge, and there wasn't a cop on the force who wouldn't want to be part of that. Never mind all the outside critics, the investigations and the lawsuits. This was to serve and protect in its rawest form. Bosch felt no choice but to go all in. Tranquilo Cortez had not played by the rules. He had his men take Bosch from his home, from the place his daughter often slept. There can be no greater crime against a police officer than to threaten his family. You do that, and all bets are off. So when Bosch called it a good plan, he meant it, and he hoped that one way or another, the threat from Tranquilo Cortez would be over before midnight.
Chapter 43. At 8:10 p.m., the Mustang's radio came alive with one call after another reporting that the target, Tranquilo Cortez, had been spotted and was on the move. Interpreting the radio code used by the SIS officers, Bosch deduced that Cortez was with an unidentified bodyguard slash driver and had gotten into a white Chrysler 300 with a lowered suspension. The car had illegally smoked windows that made it impossible to identify those behind the glass. The Chrysler was eastbound on Roscoe, and Cespedes let the entourage of SIS vehicles go by before putting the Mustang in play. Still, he hung back to see if Cortez had initiated any counter-surveillance techniques
such as a long lead follow car. When he was satisfied there was none, he pulled into traffic to catch up to the others. His role as commander of the unit was to hang behind and be ready to move up into one of the corners of the floating box surveillance surrounding the Chrysler should one of the four cars' rotating positions be made by the suspect or otherwise taken out of commission. Bosch heard over the radio that the Chrysler had turned north on Branford, which would lead directly into the park and golf course at Hanson Dam. Bosch listened as units identified themselves over the radio as Advance, Backdoor, and Outrigger 1 and 2, and kept a running report on the moving surveillance. The voices were calm and slow, as if they were describing a golf match on TV. "Where are we going in the park?" Bosch asked. "The golf course parking lot," Cespedes said. "Should be empty right about now. Can't play golf in the dark, right?" Bosch had asked the question as an attempt to get Cespedes talking about the plan. They were about a mile from the park, and Bosch didn't know what the tactical strategy would be once they reached the takedown spot. "It's going to come down to a choice," Cespedes said. "It always does." "What do you mean?" Bosch asked. "What choice?" "To live or die. The plan is always about containment first. We will put him into a situation where he knows he isn't getting out of the box. He then has a choice. Go out on his feet or on his back. It's amazing how many times these guys make the wrong choice." Bosch just nodded. "This is the guy who had you abducted," Cespedes said. "From the place your daughter calls home. Then he was going to torture you and feed your body to his dogs." "That's right," Bosch said. "Sounds like a movie I saw once. I heard somebody say that. I missed it." "Yeah, well, we need to teach these people that the movies aren't real life. Bring a little truth to the situation, you know what I mean?"
"I do."
"How's the case against him going?"
"Nowhere. We got a guy in a coma, a cop. If he comes out of it and talks, then maybe we make a case.
But you never saw Cortez, right? When you were in the cage?"
"No."
"So in other words, you don't have shit. If we take him in on this bullshit child support thing, you get a shot at talking to him, and you gotta hope that first, he doesn't lawyer up, and second, he says the wrong thing and craps on himself."
"That's about right, yeah."
"Well then let's hope he makes the wrong choice tonight." The radio came alive a few moments later with reports that the Chrysler carrying Cortez was entering the Hanson Dam recreation area. Two of the surveillance cars from the floating box had entered ahead and were in layup positions, waiting for the Chrysler to enter the felony stop trap.
"We got a decoy car in the lot," Cespedes told Bosch. "A Ford pickup like the guy whose phone we used drives. Cortez goes to it, we move in."
Bosch nodded. By leaning into the center console of the Mustang, he was able to get an angle on the laptop screen and watch the four dash cameras from the surveillance cars. He noticed that two cars were moving in traffic, not having entered the park yet, and two were static. The view on these was now set to infrared. One angle was simply down a driveway next to a building that Bosch assumed was the golf course clubhouse. The other looked across a parking lot at a pickup truck, backed into a space at the far end of the lot.
"Is there a delay on these screens?" he asked.
"About 2.5 seconds, Cespedes said.
"Recording?"
"Recording." The radio went from an overlapping of voices reporting the movement of the target to complete silence for nearly 30 seconds before the trap was sprung. Soon Bosch saw the Chrysler enter the parking lot in one of the static camera angles, but it stopped dead before approaching the pickup.
"What's he doing?" Bosch asked.
"Just being cautious," Cespedes said. Cespedes then went on the radio.
"Give him a wink, Jimmy."
"Roger that." On the dash cam from the follow car in the lot, the pickup's headlights blinked twice. Bosch noticed that all four of the camera views were static now, and on infrared.
"You got a guy in the pickup?" Bosch said, stating the obvious.
Cespedes held up a hand for silence. Now was not the time to give Bosch the play-by-play. He went back on the radio. "Now bail, Jimmy. Get out of there." The Chrysler started moving toward the pickup. Bosch saw no indication that anyone had gotten out of the Ford. Cespedes timed the Chrysler's approach, factored in the delay on the cameras,
and then stomped on the radio transmit button on the floor of the car. Now, all units, go! All four camera views started moving and closing in. Far behind, Cespedes picked up speed, and the Mustang entered the park. The car bounced on the uneven roadway as they sped toward the golf course, but Bosch couldn't take his eyes off the laptop screen. He gripped his armrest with one hand, and the laptop mount with the other, in an effort to hold it steady, and watch the action as it played out. The four surveillance cars closed in on the Chrysler as it pulled into a slot next to the pickup. Bosch could see as the cameras got closer that the truck was backed up to an ivy-draped wall. There would be no escape that way. The four follow cars moved in, their dash cams revealing that they had a classic spread formation on the Chrysler. It was trapped with its nose against a wall, and four cars with armed officers fanned behind it across a 120-degree arc. The camera angles overlapped, and Bosch could see SIS officers using the open doors of their cars as cover and pointing weapons at the Chrysler. There was no sound, but Bosch knew they were yelling and demanding the surrender of the men inside. Bosch could see two officers in combat stances moving to the left and right of the SIS cars to further contain the Chrysler, but still keep an angle that would clear them of any crossfire. For 10 seconds, there was nothing. No movement from the Chrysler. Its smoked windows were up, but the high-powered beams of the SIS cars cut through, and Bosch could make out the silhouettes of the two men inside. The Mustang entered the parking lot and sped toward the confrontation. Bosch glanced up to get his bearings, but then looked back down at the camera screens. It was then that the front doors of the Chrysler opened simultaneously. Bosch first saw the hands of the passenger come out of the car, held high and open as Tranquilo Cortez emerged to surrender. He was wearing the same flat-brimmed Dodgers hat he had worn on the day they met. The driver followed, but held only his left hand up as he emerged. The Mustang had pulled behind one of the follow cars and was now close enough for Bosch to hear the tense voices from the officers. He looked over the laptop to watch the action play live. Hands! Both hands! Hands up! And then the warning turned to alarm. Gun! Gun! Bosch could only see the driver's head and shoulders because one of the SIS cars was between them. He looked down at the laptop screen, and then to the camera angle, showing the driver's side of the Chrysler. The driver, a stocky man who had to twist his body to step out of the car, was emerging, turning, and bringing his right arm up in a swinging motion. When his arm cleared his body, Bosch saw the gun. A tremendous volley of shots seemed to come from all around him. Tranquilo Cortez paid for his bodyguard's bravado and suicidal decision to wield the gun. Cortez was centered in the killing ground and was fair game. Both men were hit repeatedly as fire continued from the 8 shooters fanned around them. The Chrysler's windows shattered, and the men on either side of it went down. Cortez had actually turned, possibly seeking cover, and went face first back into the car. His body then fell out, and he was left leaning against the door sill, head down. His hat never came off. Only when the gunfire stopped did Bosch look back up from the laptop screen. Through an angle between the open doors of two of the follow cars, he could see Cortez, the front of his white shirt soaked in blood. His head jerked as his body seized. For the moment, he was still alive. "Stay in the car, Bosch," Cespedes yelled. He jumped out and ran between two of the cars and through the heavy smoke of the gunfire. He followed two of his men who were cautiously approaching the Chrysler with guns trained on the men on the ground. Bosch went back to the laptop, turning it fully toward him now, because the view was better. There was a gun on the ground, next to the bodyguard's body. One of the SIS officers kicked it away, and then leaned down to check the body for a pulse. He made a hand signal, a flat line, indicating the bodyguard was dead. Cortez was pulled down flat on the ground, and an officer knelt next to him. Even on the infrared screen, it was clear he was breathing. Cespedes was on the screen now, already talking on a cell phone. Bosch assumed he was calling for rescue ambulances or making notifications to command staff. Bosch wanted to get out of the Mustang and enter the scene, but he remained as ordered in the car. If it appeared that Cespedes had forgotten him, he would get out. He saw Cespedes disconnect from a call and make another. Bosch looked at the screen and saw the same action again, remembering that the feed to the laptop was delayed. He looked at the keyboard, located the left arrow, and pressed it. The video on the screen started rewinding. Bosch held his finger on the button until the images reversed past the shooting and the two Sanfors were still in the white Chrysler. He replayed the fatal confrontation, tapping the reverse button intermittently to slow down the playback or to entirely replay moments. He wasn't sure how to set the playback to slow motion. He focused on the camera angle on the upper left corner of the screen. It was an almost straight-on view of the driver emerging from the car with one hand up. He focused on the driver's right arm as it moved out of the shadows of the car. As the arm came up from behind his torso, Bosch could see the gun. But the hand was not grasping it by the grip. The driver was holding the weapon, but it was not in a ready-fire grip. Then Bosch saw an impact on the car as a bullet hit the door frame and fragmented. The first shot. It had come before the gun could have been clearly seen and the driver's intentions made apparent. Bosch took his finger off the keyboard and let the rest of the shooting play out. He looked up through the windshield and saw Cespedes walking toward the Mustang. He quickly put his finger on the forward arrow and sped the playback, catching it up to real time just as the SIS boss opened the passenger side door. Cespedes leaned in. "He's circling but conscious. If you want to say anything to him," he said. "Okay," Bosch said. "Yeah." Cespedes backed away, and Bosch got out. They walked between two of the SIS cars and to the passenger side of the Chrysler. A heavy pall of smoke still hung in the air. Cortez's eyes were open and looked fearful. Blood was on his tongue and lips, and Bosch knew his lungs had likely been riddled with fragmented lead. Harry was shocked by how young he looked. The man who had sneered and postured in the Lavanderia parking lot a few days before was gone. Cortez now looked like a scared boy in a baseball cap. Bosch knew it was not the time to say anything, to play the victor or to taunt him with vengeful words. He said nothing. Cortez said nothing as well. He locked eyes with Bosch and then moved his arm and reached a bloody hand to the cuff of Bosch's pants. He grabbed hold of it, as though he might be able to hang on to life and keep from being pulled into the waiting darkness. But after a few seconds, he lost his strength. He let go, then closed his eyes and died.
Ballard. Chapter 44. Ballard spread the final shake cards out on a table in the break room. There was more room here than on a borrowed desk in the detective bureau. She was waiting for Bosch. She had been through the cards and done the electronic backgrounding. It was time to work these in the field. If Bosch got in before it was too late, they could possibly knock off a few during the night. She wanted to text or call him to say she was waiting, but remembered that he had no phone. She was sitting there, staring at the cards, when Lieutenant Monroe came in to get a cup of coffee.
"Ballard, what are you doing in so early?"
he asked. "Just working on my hobby case," she said. She didn't look up from the cards, and he didn't look up from his prepping of his coffee.
"That old murder of the girl?"
Monroe asked. "The girl, right," Ballard said. She moved two cards across the table to the lesser priority side.
"What's it got to do with that tattoo artist?" Monroe asked. "That one was solved."
Now Ballard looked over at Monroe. "What are you talking about, LT?" she asked.
"Sorry, I guess I was being snoopy," Monroe said. "I saw a murder book in your mail slot when I was going through the records retention box. I took a quick look. I remember that one, but they got the bad guy on it pretty quick, from what I can remember."
The Zutu book. Ballard had been waiting on it but had forgotten to check her slot when she had come in from dinner. "They did clear it," she said. "I just wanted a look at it. Thanks for letting me know it's there." She walked out of the break room and down the back hallway to the mail room, where every officer and detective in the division had an open slot for internal and external deliveries. She pulled the plastic binder out of her slot. Monroe was gone when she got back to the break room. She decided to review the murder book there, so she would not have to leave the spread of shake cards unattended. She sat down and opened the binder. The design of a murder book was consistent across all department homicide squads. It was divided into 26 sections: crime scene reports, lab reports, photos, witness statements, and so on. The first section was always the chronological record, where the case investigators logged their moves by date and time. Ballard flipped back to section 16, which contained the crime scene photos. Ballard pulled a thick stack of 3x5 photos out of a plastic pocket and started looking through them. The photographer had been thorough and clinical. It seemed that every inch of the tattoo parlor and the murder scene had been documented in the bright, almost overexposed prints. In 2009, the department was still using film, as digital photography had not yet been accepted by the court system because of concerns about digital tampering. Ballard moved quickly through the photos until she reached those photos of the victim's body at the center of the crime scene. Audie Haslam had put up a fight. Her arms, hands, and fingers were all deeply lacerated with defensive wounds. Eventually, though, she succumbed to her larger and more powerful attacker. There were deep stab wounds in her chest and neck. Blood completely soaked the Zutu tank top she was wearing. Arterial spray had splashed all four walls of the small storage room the killer had pushed her into. She died on the polished concrete floor, with one hand clasping a crucifix on a chain around her neck. Incongruously, the tattoo artist had no tattoos herself, at least none that were visible to Ballard in the photos. Murder was murder, and Ballard knew that every case deserved the full attention and effort of the police department. But Ballard was always struck by the murder of a woman. Most times, the cases she reviewed and worked were exceedingly violent. Most times, the killers were men. There was something deeply affecting about that. Something unfair that went beyond the general unfairness of death at the hands of another. She wondered how men would live if they knew that in every moment of their lives, their size and nature made them vulnerable to the opposite sex. She stacked the photos and slid them back into the pocket of section 16. Then she went to section 12, which was dedicated to the suspect. She wanted to see a photo of the man who had killed Audie Haslam. In his booking photo, Clancy DeVoe stared at the camera with dead eyes and an expression that seemed devoid of human empathy. He was unshaven and unclean, and one eyelid drooped farther than the other. A straight, thin-lipped mouth was set in a smirk of defiance rather than an expression of guilt or apology. He was a hardened psychopath who had probably hurt many before the killing of Audie Haslam brought his run to an end. Ballard guessed that most of those victims, whatever the crimes, were women. A printout of his prior record substantiated this. He had been charged numerous times, going back to his juvenile days in Mississippi. The crimes ranged from drug possession to multiple aggravated assaults and an attempted murder. The list did not denote the gender of the victims, but Ballard knew. DeVoe was a woman hater. You didn't stab a woman in the back room of a tattoo parlor as many times and with as much ferocity as he had, without building toward it over years. Poor Audie Haslam was at the wrong place at the wrong time. She had probably set her own death in motion with the wrong word or a judgmental look that set DeVoe off. A notation on the pocket of Section 12 said that DeVoe was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the murder in the tattoo parlor. He would never hurt a woman again. From there, Ballard went to the section containing the statements of witnesses in the case. There was no witness to the actual murder, because the killer had waited until he was alone in the shop before robbing and murdering Haslam. But the investigators had run down and talked to other customers who had been in the shop that night. Ballard took out a notebook and started writing down the names of the witnesses and their contact information. They were all denizens of the Hollywood Night, circa 2009, and they might be useful to interview if they could be located now. She realized that one of these witnesses, a man named David Manning, sounded familiar. She put the murder book aside and looked over the shake cards she had spread out for Bosch's perusal. She found Manning. According to the witness statement, Manning had been in the tattoo shop less than 2 hours before the murder. He was described as a 58-year-old ex-smuggler from Florida. He lived in an old RV he parked on different streets in Hollywood on different days of the week. He was a frequent visitor to Zoo 2 because he liked Audie Haslam and liked to add to the prodigious collection of tattoos that sleeved both his arms. From reading between the lines of the statement, which had been written before the investigation focused on Clancy DeVoe, it appeared to Ballard that Manning was an early person of interest in the Haslam case. He had a record, albeit one without violence, and was one of the last people to see her alive. He was actually in police custody and being interviewed when the results of fingerprint analysis from the crime scene came in and put the investigation in a different direction. Much of the information on the shake card matched that on the witness statement. The shake card had made the final cut with Ballard because of Manning's RV. It fell in with the van category that Ballard and Bosch were interested in. The card had been written 7 weeks before the Clayton and Haslam murders, when an officer had inspected the RV parked on Argyle just south of Santa Monica, and told Manning it was illegal to park the recreational vehicle in a commercial parking zone. At the time, the LAPD was not shy about rousting the homeless and keeping them moving. But since then, a series of civil rights lawsuits and a change in leadership in City Hall had led to a revision in that practice, and now bullying the homeless was practically a firing offense. Consequently, there was almost no enforcement of laws with them, and someone like Manning would be allowed to park his RV just about anywhere he wanted to in Hollywood, as long as it was not in front of a single-family home or a movie theater. The officer who had rousted Manning in 2009 had filled out a field interview card with information garnered from their short conversation and his Florida driver's license. When Ballard had run Manning's name and birth date through the database as she prepped the cards for Bosch, she had determined that he now had a California license, but the address on it was unhelpful. Manning had followed a routine tactic of using a church address as his own in order to get a California license or identification card. Though the address was a dead end, the RV registered to Manning should not be too hard to spot if he was still living in the area. Ballard now picked up the Manning shake card and moved it over to the row of cards that she believed warranted a higher priority of attention. The fact that he knew, liked, and might have been obsessed with a woman who was murdered 2 days before Daisy Clayton was, in her estimation, worth checking out. Ballard wanted to talk to him. She opened her laptop and went to work on an information-only bulletin on Manning. The bulletin was an informal bolo with instructions. If Manning or his RV is spotted, do not roust or arrest. Just contact Ballard 24/7. She printed out the page, which included a description and plate number for the RV, and then walked it back down to the watch office to give to Lieutenant Monroe. When she got there, Monroe was standing with two other officers in the middle of the room and looking up at the flat screen mounted high on the wall over the watch commander's desk. Ballard could see the logo of Channel 9, the local 24-hour news channel, and a reporter she recognized doing a live stand-up with the flashing lights of several police vehicles behind her. Ballard walked up beside them. "What's this?" she asked.
"Police shooting in the valley," Monroe said. "Two bangers down for the count."
"Is it SIS? The Bosch surveillance?"
They're not saying anything about it on this. They don't know shit yet.
Ballard pulled her phone and texted Heather Rourke, the airship spotter.
You over this thing in the valley?
No, south end tonight. Heard about it. 2 Ks.
Is it the Bosch thing? SIS?
Sounds like. Checking. She still had no working number for Bosch. She stared at the screen, watching the activity behind the reporter, but not listening to what she was saying until she finished with her exact location. Reporting live from the Hanson Dam Recreation Area. Ballard knew that meant Foothill Division, and most likely, Sanford's. It had to be the Bosch case, so she knew she would probably not be seeing him tonight. She went back to the break room, stacked the shake cards according to priority, and then carried them and the Zutu murder book back to the detective bureau. She checked the clock and saw that her shift didn't start for an hour. She considered for a moment driving up to the valley and crashing the SIS shooting scene. She felt proprietary about the case, considering her part in the rescue of Harry Bosch. But she knew she would be kept on the fringe. The SIS was a closed society. Bosch would be lucky if they even let him under the yellow tape. She decided not to go, and instead opened the murder book again to complete her review. She turned to Section 1, the chronological record. This was as close as she would get to riding along on the investigation. The chrono was a step-by-step accounting of the case detective's movements. She started at the beginning, from the moment they were called out from home and sent to the tattoo parlor. The case was carried by 2 detectives assigned to the Hollywood Homicide Squad before it had been dissolved, and cases from the division were folded into West Bureau Homicide. Their names were Livingstone and Peppers. Ballard knew neither of them. The chrono, like the murder book, was shorter than what Ballard had seen in other murder books, including those she had prepared herself during her time in the robbery homicide division. But this was not a measure of the effort by Livingstone and Peppers. It was because the case so quickly came together. The detectives were moving forward and thoroughly when forensics handed them a suspect on a platter. A bloody fingerprint from the rear storage room of the shop was connected to Clancy DeVoe. He was quickly located and picked up. A broken knife, believed to have been the murder weapon, was recovered in his possession, and the case was considered closed in less than 24 hours. All murder cases should go so easily, Ballard thought, but they usually don't. A girl gets snatched off the street and murdered, and 9 years go by without so much as a clue to her killer. A woman gets brutally slashed with a knife in the back room of her business, and the case is closed in a day. There was no rhyme or reason to murder investigation. After the arrest, the entries in the chronological record started tapering off as the case shifted from investigation to preparation for prosecution. But one entry in the log gave Ballard pause. It came in 48 hours after the murder and 24 hours after Clancy DeVoe was arrested. It was an innocuous entry, simply added for thoroughness. It said that 2 nights after the murder, at 7:45 p.m., Detective Peppers was notified by the watch sergeant at Hollywood Division that a crime scene cleaner named Roger Dillon had found additional evidence on the Zutu case. This was described as a broken piece of knife blade that had been on the floor of the storage room, but had been completely covered by the pool of blood that had flowed from the victim and then coagulated around her body. The 2-inch blade had apparently gone completely unnoticed by the detectives and forensic techs. Peppers wrote in the log that he asked the watch sergeant to dispatch a patrol team to go to the tattoo parlor, take the blade from Dillon, and bag it as evidence. Peppers, who lived more than an hour from Los Angeles, said he would pick up the evidence in the morning. Ballard stared at the log entry for a long time. As far as the Zutu case went, it was strictly housekeeping. She knew that if the blade matched the broken knife recovered during the DeVoe arrest, then detectives had another piece of significant evidence against the suspect. She wasn't bothered by the seeming gaffe made by the crime scene team. It was, in fact, not unusual for evidence to be missed or left behind at a complicated and bloody crime scene. Spilled blood can hide a lot. What gave Ballard pause was the cleaner. By coincidence, Ballard had met Roger Dillon earlier in the week, when he had discovered the burglary of the Warhol prints from the house on Hollywood Boulevard. She still had the business cards he had given her in her briefcase. The log entry documented that Dillon had called about the broken blade at 7:45 on the same night Daisy Clayton disappeared. It meant that Dillon had been working in Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard just a few hours before. Ballard had seen his work van earlier in the week and had gotten only a quick glimpse inside it, but she had seen inside others like it at other crime scenes. She knew Dillon had chemicals and tools for cleaning, and he would have containers for the safe transport and disposal of biologically hazardous materials. All in a moment, Ballard knew. She had to look at Roger Dillon. Chapter 45. Ballard went to her locker to store the shake cards and the Haslam murder book. She then pulled out the fledgling murder book Bosch had started putting together on the Clayton case. She sat on a bench in the locker room and opened it up, immediately flipping to Bosch's report on the plastic container manufactured by American Storage Products. He listed the sales supervisor he had talked to as Dell Middleburg. Ballard almost jumped up off the bench with joy when she saw that Bosch, thorough detective that he was, had listed both Middleburg's office and cell numbers. It was after 10. She called the cell, and it was answered with a suspicious hello. Mr. Middleburg?
I'm not interested.
This is the police. Don't hang up.
The police?
Mr. Middleburg, my name is Renee Ballard. I'm a detective with the Los Angeles Police. You recently talked with a colleague of mine named Bosch about containers made by American Storage Products. Do you remember?
That was a couple of months ago.
Correct. We are still working that case.
It's 10:15. What is so urgent that this couldn't...
Mr. Middleburg, I'm sorry, but it is urgent. You told Detective Bosch that your company made some direct sales of the containers to commercial accounts.
We do, yes.
Are you at home, Mr. Middleburg?
Where else would I be?
Do you have a laptop or access to sales records involving those commercial accounts? There was a pause while Middleburg considered the question. Ballard held her breath. The case had been full of long shots. It was about time one of them paid off. If Dillon operated a business that ran close to the line, she remembered he had commented about competition, then he might be just the kind of man to seek a direct sale discount from a manufacturer.
I have some access to records, Middleburg finally said.
I have the name of a company, Ballard said. Can you see if they have ever been a customer of ASP?
Hold the line. I'm going to my home office.
Ballard waited while Middleburg got to his computer. She heard a partially muffled discussion as he told someone that he was talking to the police and he would be up as soon as he was finished.
Okay, he then said directly into the phone. I'm at my computer. What's the name of the company?
It's called Chemical Bioservices, Ballard said. Chemical is broken into two.
No, nothing, Middleburg said.
You spelled it with a dash?
Nothing beginning with C-H-E-M.
Ballard felt deflated. She needed something more in order to go all in on Dillon. Then she remembered the truck she had seen on the day they met on Hollywood Boulevard. Okay, try just CCB services, please, she said urgently. She heard typing, and then Middleburg responded.
Yes, he said. A customer since 2008. They order soft plastics.
Ballard stood up, holding the phone tight against her ear.
What kind of soft plastics? She asked.
Storage containers, different sizes.
Ballard remembered Bosch giving her the ASP container he had bought. It was still in the trunk of her city ride.
Including the 25-gallon container with the snap on top?
There was a pause while Middleburg checked the records.
Yes, he finally said.
He ordered those.
Thank you, Mr. Middleburg, Ballard said. One of us will follow up with you during business hours.
She disconnected and went back to her locker. She put the murder book back on the top shelf and opened her briefcase, retrieving one of the business cards Dylan had given her. His company had an address on Sadakoy Street in Van Nuys. When Ballard entered the watch office, Monroe was still looking up at the TV screen.
Anything new? She asked.
Not much, Monroe said. But they did say the dead guys were persons of interest in an abduction case. It's gotta be the Bosch thing.
You hear from him?
Not yet. I'm heading out to do an interview on my hobby case. Might not be back for roll call. Ballard stared at the screen for a moment. It was the same reporter on another stand-up. If Bosch happens to show up here, can you give him this? He'll know what it means. She handed him the card with Dylan's name and business address on it. He looked at it disinterestedly and then put it into one of his shirt pockets.
Will do, Monroe said. But stay in touch, Ballard, okay? Let me know where you are.
You got it, LT.
And if I need you on a call, the hobby case goes back on the shelf and you come running.
Roger that.
Ballard doubled back to the detective bureau and grabbed a rover out of the charging station and the keys to the city ride. She left out the back door into the parking lot. Ballard took Laurel Canyon Boulevard over the mountain and then down into the valley. It was near midnight when she turned down Sadakoy and into an industrial sector lined with warehouses and fleet lots near the Van Nuys Airport. Chemical Bioservices was in a warehouse park called the Sadakoy Industry Center, where manufacturing and service businesses were lined side by side in duplicate duplex warehouses. Ballard drove down the center lane and by Dylan's business, and then out the other side of the industrial park. It looked like none of the businesses were open this late at night. She found parking on a side street and walked back. Dylan had only a small sign on his warehouse. It wasn't the kind of business that drew customers who were either walking or driving by. His was the kind of service you found through internet searches or recommendations from professionals in the same arena.